Chapter 30. During her interviews, Brenda DeJordan became quite emotional about Dorothy Kilgallen's death, regarding the effect it had on her family. She told this author, "My parents were so heartbroken when she died, very distraught. They left the house shortly thereafter. They didn't believe she died accidentally. And my dad didn't believe she killed herself. Made no sense. Made him suspicious. He was scared to say anything, and he was not the type to be bullied. Didn't scare easily. He was a courageous man, but my mother told my father, 'Don't say anything. It won't bring her back.'" DeJordan added, "It was the saddest day of his life for my father. Dad took it hard, because he always had her back, would do anything for her. They were very close." Continuing, DeJordan said, "Dad was very upset. Mom was angry. Both were told that if anyone asks about Dorothy's death, to not say anything. Lots of pressure. And my dad didn't cow down to anyone. He wasn't loud, didn't curse, intelligent. Always rooted for the underdog." Continuing, DeJordan said, "An example is that when we moved to the Bronx, it was a white neighborhood. Boxer Sugar Ray Robinson's manager lived next door. We were the only black families. I told Dad someone was following me and Larry. He went to the police and said, 'I've got two kids who are being followed, and if I don't get help, I will take care of this.' There were no other problems then. Dad was strong, and it worked. He cast a big shadow. He was 6'4" and neat as a pin, a very particular dresser." Regarding her father's friendship with Kilgallen, DeJordan stated, "Dad and Dorothy had a great relationship. Took him and Mom a long time to get over her death, and the way she passed. Said it was too coincidental. Working on the JFK assassination, really getting information. He told my mom the way he found her was not the way the authorities found her later. And my father said Dorothy would never mix barbs and alcohol." Speaking to what happened once Kilgallen died, DeJordan said, "There was no investigation, and that made my father very upset. He was contradicting the cause of death and told to be quiet about that. Dad said her death didn't add up. My mother told my father, 'It won't be good for you to speak up. You have to protect your family.' Even when we got older, my brother Larry and I, my father would not talk about Dorothy's death. But I heard him tell my mother, 'It's not fair that they killed her.' But Dad always asked me not to say anything about Dorothy's death. That happened all the way to 1980. Critics of DeJordan's account will be skeptical, since it is clear that most of everything she recalls is based on either what her father told her or what her mother told her that her father related regarding events during the course of Kilgallen's life and on the day her body was discovered. Certainly, DeJordan's evidence is dimmed by the fact that it is hearsay, causing it, in all likelihood, to be excluded in a court of law. However, what she recalled appeared quite credible to this author, and also his wife, who was present for the New York City interviews. Despite being at a young age when Kilgallen died, DeJordan's memory appeared sharp, and she was not given any prompting by this author regarding any facts about Kilgallen's death prior to answering questions. With this in mind, DeJordan's version of what may have transpired during the hours following Kilgallen's death may be factored into previous evidence collected from Mark Sinclair and others, and weighed appropriately as to the truth of what happened on November 8, 1965. DeJordan's thoughts do coincide with much of what Sinclair recalled, especially his belief that Kilgallen's body had been moved from where it was originally discovered. Why he believed this to be true is not evident. He was never asked the question during his lengthy interviews. DeJordan's recollection that her father told her he found Kilgallen's body in the bathroom after searching for her, first in the Kloop, where she normally slept, is logical in nature. If true, then her stating, "When my father saw Dorothy's body in the bedroom, he said, 'She doesn't go to bed like this. Hairpiece, eyelashes, etc. Not in these bedclothes.' Also rings true. Similar to other evidence gathered through 5 decades and counting since Kilgallen died, DeJordan's statements must be fairly evaluated as part of the continuing mystery into why, how, and by whom Kilgallen died. Like other witnesses, DeJordan's veracity is on trial and is subject to scrutiny when compared with the most credible evidence gathered since 1965. Explanations for the death scene irregularities noted by Mark Sinclair and through Brenda DeJordan's account lead to several plausible scenarios. Each must be considered when determining how Kilgallen may have died, especially since, while Sinclair discovered Kilgallen's body in the bedroom, DeJordan's version tells a separate tale, that her father found Kilgallen dead in the bathroom next to the 3rd-floor dressing room. Taking Clement's alternative account into consideration, that another person accompanied Kilgallen into the townhouse and later left, appears to let Richard off the hook as being responsible for her death. This is true, unless, later on, Kilgallen awakened Richard because she couldn't sleep and asked for sleep aids since she had run out of Seconal. Recall the empty vial that later disappeared. Then he, as noted, either intentionally or unintentionally, gave her too high a dosage of pills, which killed her when mixed with alcohol. If this scenario is accepted as true, when Clement informed Richard that his wife was dead, he led him to the bathroom, and then Richard decided to make his dead wife presentable, so that when her body was discovered, she looked as beautiful in death as she had in life. This meant he had been the one who moved Kilgallen's body to the spare bedroom, where he then undressed her, stripping Kilgallen of the dress she wore to What's My Line, and replacing it with more suitable clothes from her closet. Continuing to stage the death scene, Richard could have decided to leave on her hairpiece, makeup, and false eyelashes, so any photographs would capture her beauty. The change of clothes complete, Richard could have placed her under the covers and positioned the book, The Honey Badger, on her lap. To make certain her body was preserved, he may have turned on the air conditioner, an act Sinclair suspected had happened by whoever was with her when the body was first discovered. To point any investigation toward accidental death or even suicide and away from responsibility on his part, if he was responsible, Richard could have placed the empty Seconal drug vial on the night table while forgetting to position her reading glasses there. This was an oversight that should have been noticed by Dr. Luke and/or Detective Doyle, but neither apparently took the time to ask anyone whether Kilgallen needed reading glasses. One important question surfaces regarding this potential scenario. Since it has been determined that Kilgallen's body was discovered several hours before the police were notified, why did Richard wait to inform them if he did? Was he privy to the FBI being alerted to Kilgallen's death, resulting in agents filtering into the townhouse and confiscating Kilgallen's papers? Perhaps her JFK assassination files? No exact answer appears possible, but the time lapse between when the body was found and when the police arrived causes suspicion that either Richard could have alerted the government agents or simply stood aside when they arrived. Additionally, it's possible that Richard began drinking and, in his diminished state, was unable to make any decision. By the time the police, other officials, and friends arrived, he was drunk. What is known for sure are Kilgallen's movements on the late afternoon evening of November 7, 1965, and the early morning hours of November 8. This information assists in the consideration of what happened before her body was discovered. These events are preparation for her final What's My Line show, appearance on the program, the time spent with Bob Bach at P.J. Clark's directly after the program, the stop at the Regency Hotel bar to meet a companion, who author Lee Israel called the Mystery Man, the time between leaving the bar and arriving home, entrance into the townhouse, entrance on the 3rd floor and the master bedroom, body being discovered. Addressing Kilgallen's final program preparation, Mark Sinclair, one of the few people to see her in the raw, with no makeup, hair ruffled, no fake eyelashes, even not fully dressed, recalled, "Dorothy was subdued, but no more than usual. She was tired because she was out the night before. She was going home afterwards, but obviously she didn't, because she went to the Regency." He added that she planned to wear a long, white silk file evening gown on the program. When reminded she had worn it the week before, Kilgallen said, "I don't care." Regarding the dress, Sinclair said, "She wanted to wear that dress. It was cumbersome, because that dress took up the back seat of the limo. We always discussed clothes ahead of time, because if it was an evening dress, I would do her hairstyle more elaborate than I would do for a shorter cocktail dress." To accentuate her appearance, Sinclair had woven fake flowers collected from a vase in the townhouse entrance hall into Kilgallen's hair, believing the flowers would go well with the dress she had chosen. He called it a very formal dress. Sinclair recalled being shocked when he watched What's My Line that evening. He immediately noticed Kilgallen had apparently changed her mind before the show. She had, he stated, discarded the silk file dress for a low-cut, wing-sleeve chiffon dress by designer Anne Fogarty. Note, later, in an audio-taped interview, Sinclair stated, "When I came in the bedroom that morning from the dressing room and found Kilgallen's body, that white silk file dress was hanging up." A stickler for fashion detail, Sinclair believed the short dress did not mesh well with the flowers in her hair. "She couldn't take the flowers out because they were woven into the hairpiece," Sinclair said. He added, "Obviously there was something to make her change that dress at the last minute. After I left, I think she got a phone call at home from somebody, and she agreed to meet whoever it was at the Regency. That's my belief, because she wasn't going to PJ Clark's." Note, in his videotaped interview, Sinclair said he visited the Regency Hotel Cocktail Lounge many times, stating, "I had clients who stayed there, so I'd go by there and do their hair, especially people from out of town like Princess Margaret." Sinclair continued, "Dorothy had asked me if I wanted to meet her later, because she did not have anybody she was going to meet with, and she was not dressing for a date." Concerning her having visited Clark's, Sinclair said, "Well, maybe, but not long. She might have done that and then gone home, but it wouldn't have been an evening like she had." Kilgallen, while he was fixing her hair, apparently asked Sinclair to meet him after the program. He said, "I was tired myself. She had done something every day that week, and she had more appointments for me the following week. And I didn't want to see her anymore. I wanted to go home." Note, Kilgallen requesting that Sinclair join her following the show happened when he was helping her get ready for the program. This means she apparently had no plans to meet anyone else until she received the phone call Sinclair suspected had changed her plans. During Kilgallen's final What's My Line performance, there was no apparent change from her usual program demeanor. Just minutes before the program began, director Franklin Heller chatted with Kilgallen in her dressing room. He said she was quite normally composed in every way. He added that the two talked about her travel abroad. This may have alluded to Charles Simpson's belief that Kilgallen had planned a trip to London. When one considers whether Kilgallen was in any depressed mood, so she could have taken her own life, watching the show puts an end to that consideration, since her mood was just as moderator John Charles Daly later said it was. "Dorothy was just full of beans last night. She was in great spirits." Viewing the taped show confirms this observation. With sharp questioning, as noted, Kilgallen guessed the identity of Catherine Williams Stone, who sold dynamite. Kilgallen later teased Bennett Cerf about his comments to Eleanor Kane, now Penna, the woman who was a football writer, one of very few, if any, during this time. At one point, her column was syndicated to more than 60 newspapers, although she told this author in February 2018 that she was never allowed even in the press box during games. Ms. Penna, now an avid collector and dealer of Staffordshire figures, shared a dressing room with TV star Joey Heatherton before Penna's appearance on the program as the final contestant. She stumped the panel, even though Kilgallen guessed her being a writer, but not what type of writer. Penna, 82 years old in 2018, recalled to this author having been around Kilgallen more than 30 times at P.J. Clark's. She said, "My close friend, Daniel Lavezzo Jr., the owner of the saloon, used to take me to racetracks like Aqueduct, and may have even accompanied me to Dick Colmar's restaurant in New Jersey." She added, "At Clark's, Dorothy and I sat at the same table near the back. Dorothy knew me, but didn't know me, if you know what I mean, since she was famous and busy with the others who were around. These included Bob Bach, who was very easygoing and fun, and Jean Bach, Arlene Francis and her husband Martin, and sometimes Dick. When she guessed my being a writer, she hadn't put two and two together of our mixing at Clark's." Ms. Penna recalled Kilgallen as being prissy, very ladylike, wore those white gloves, had just a slight lisp. She said she spent time with Kilgallen after the What's My Line program and recalled her being normal, that her words were not slurred, while adding, "I'd swear she had taken no drugs or alcohol." When a man who owned the Hollywood Wax Museum appeared on the program and stumped the panel, Kilgallen quipped, "This is our own wax museum," jokingly referring to the advanced age of her and her fellow panelists. Following the program, Kilgallen showed Cerf the Murder One preface. By all accounts, Cerf was impressed. Without question, Kilgallen's and Bob Bach's stop at P.J. Clark's was a brief one. In Lee Israel's Kilgallen biography, she wrote that Kilgallen and Bach elbowed their way through the packed house before being seated by Frankie Ribondo, Table 36's maitre d'. A favorite waiter, Patty Blue, brought Kilgallen a drink, apparently vodka and tonic. As has happened with so much information about Kilgallen's life and times, this account is only partially true. Through Pat Moore, a revered waitress at Clark's for nearly 40 years, this author learned no women served as waitresses at Clark's until the late 1970s, an account confirmed to this author in 2018 by Daniel H. Lavezzo III, the son of the former owner. "Before that, only men were allowed to serve the customers," Moore said in February 2018. "I was the third one, I believe, to be hired, and even then many of the women customers refused to be served by women. It was like I was a foreign object to them." Regarding author Lee Israel's account, based on what she apparently considered reliable sources but who were not, Moore explained that Kilgallen's regular table was not number 36, but an oval table labeled B behind table 37, where tables A, B, and C were positioned. This configuration was confirmed by Lavezzo III, a close friend of Kilgallen. He described the saloon as intellectually stimulating, and the decor in the dining area as deliberately comfortable, informal, complete with red and white checkered tablecloths adorning the various tables. Dorothy always sat under the huge octangular clock fastened to the back wall at table B, Lavezzo said. She and all of her friends. He also told this author there was a large bentwood chair facing away from the back wall, and whoever sat there was considered to be sitting at the head of the table. Apparently, Kilgallen regularly sat in that chair. Pat Moore, who served such celebrities as Tony Bennett, Johnny Depp, and tennis star Andre Agassi, confirmed Frankie Ribondo, known as the Ayatollah of Clark's, was in all likelihood the maitre d'. However, Moore said the waiter who helped Kilgallen was Pat Baker, not Patty Blue. Lavezzo said about Baker, "He was an important fixture at Clark's." Of Kilgallen, Lavezzo recalled, "People talked about her all the time. There was a great deal of respect for her. She had significant status. She was one of the real shapers of opinion. In fact, she helped Clark's establish itself. It was a real coup that Dorothy went in there so often to her regular table. It enhanced Clark's reputation, made it quite popular." Since Kilgallen was so well known at Clark's, many patrons must have seen her with Bob Bach on the last night of her life. But at some point, she told him, as noted, that she had a late date. The two then left separately sometime past midnight. Bob Bach's wife, Jean, confirmed this version, stating, "I knew she had drinks with Bob. They'd been at P.J. Clark's." She told him to just drop her off at the Regency Hotel, since she was having a late date that night. Understanding what happened while Kilgallen spent time at the Regency Hotel is connected directly to a man she met there. Discussion of his potential identity will follow, but examining the time between when Kilgallen left the bar and when and where her body was discovered is essential. Kilgallen's townhouse, it may be recalled, was located at 45 East 68th Street, between Madison Avenue and Park Avenue. Surveillance cameras were not part of any security concerns in the mid-1960s. Witnesses, including the piano player Kurt Mayer and others to be identified, saw Kilgallen at the Regency Hotel, located 6 blocks from her townhouse, at 2 a.m. Recall that Western Union manager Dave Spiegel swore Kilgallen called him at 2:20 a.m. These accounts assist with estimating the time Kilgallen may have died. That Kilgallen placed the call to Spiegel from a pay telephone located in perhaps the lobby close to the bar, or a phone brought to her table by the bartender, seems apparent. There were no cell phones in those days. According to this timeline, she did not leave the Regency until at least 2:25 a.m. or shortly thereafter. She would not have arrived home, either by walking, highly unlikely, or by taxi, limousine, or perhaps in a car, until 2:40, or a bit later if the short trip was delayed. To date, no one has reported how Kilgallen left the Regency Hotel bar, or with whom. In his videotaped interview, Mark Sinclair said Kilgallen visited the Regency Hotel bar many times, and that she liked it because there were 3 entrances, through the lobby and down some stairs, the street entrance, and through a back entrance. Important to recall is Mark Sinclair stating that rigor mortis had set in when he discovered her body at a bit after 9 a.m. Medical evidence suggests rigor mortis begins 2 to 6 hours after someone dies. This means Kilgallen had to have died sometime before 7 a.m., since at least 2 hours had to pass before Sinclair discovered the body. Recall Dr. Luke concluded that Kilgallen died between 2 and 4 a.m., the estimate the junior medical examiner provided to a newspaper the day after Kilgallen's death. Concerning Kilgallen's time of death, Mark Sinclair said, "I don't know what time she died." Kilgallen could gain entrance to the townhouse either through the front door or rear door, which led to a garden. Each had old-fashioned locks with the keyhole in the knob. No reason exists as to why Kilgallen would not have entered through the front door. A metal box was positioned outside the front door, where Kilgallen left her newspaper columns for pickup. At some point, the messenger found the column and delivered it to the Journal American offices. Recall the afternoon edition of November 8th included the column with the notation Kilgallen had written it during the early hours. When this could have happened is unclear. The entrance hall, inside the townhouse front door, led to the flight of back stairs and elevator. Next to this room was a poorly lit area where bicycles and sleds were stored. Next to the stairs was a doorway leading to the servants' quarters. A sewing room was adjacent to a long hallway leading to the servants' small living room. This room included the door to the backyard, to the garden. Another door led to the second-floor kitchen. The home staff consisted of the Clements and Ellen O'Hara. It is difficult to ascertain everyone who had keys to the Kilgallen townhouse. Mark Sinclair, Charles Simpson, and Tudor Ibn Hassan had keys, as did the servants and Richard. Whether anyone else had spare keys, no one knows. If James Clements' account is accurate, Kilgallen did not enter the townhouse alone. What is unknown is whether the man who accompanied her was the same man she met at the Regency Hotel, someone who forced Kilgallen to let him in after she opened the door, or someone who was lying in wait inside the townhouse and surprised her when she entered. The latter suggests this person either had a key to the townhouse or picked the lock. Important to note is that Kilgallen apparently was not physically harmed, since the medical examiner's report stated there was no trauma. Retired Sheriff's Detective Dennis O'Keefe certainly suspected foul play, based on evaluation of the evidence presented in The Reporter Who Knew Too Much. He told this author, "Based on totality of the evidence and circumstances I know about the case, this should have been a murder investigation. It could have been that the authorities were just as scared to investigate as Kilgallen's family. People close to the family, what's my line colleagues, journalists, whoever, were to come forward, and that is why there was no investigation in 1965. If O'Keefe was correct, why would the authorities be scared of investigating Kilgallen's death? Why was the feminine reporter, who used only words as her weapons against dishonesty, corruption, and cover-ups, dangerous enough that probing her death frightened those in power from making certain that as a victim of a crime, she received the justice she deserved?